Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon. And today we're doing a podcast all about overfilled faces, lip filler migration, alienization of faces. And we're interviewing the extremely fabulous Dr. Stephen Harris. He's a very
Thank you.
distinguished aesthetic doctor based in the UK. He is a creative artist. He has a mother who is a painter and a father who's an inventor. And he himself is sketching and painting, drawing amazing, beautiful works of art. I always think that's an indicator of who to trust for your face as an artist. And he, of course, has been teaching about dermal fillers and his techniques and normalizing faces. He's published author regarding his understanding of lip anatomy and tubercles and the non-surgical lip tubercle technique. So, without further ado, welcome Dr. Stephen Harris. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. K. It's always a pleasure to be here. This is our second podcast, so thank you for inviting me back. It's an honor.
It's my pleasure. I feel like I discovered you long ago before you were well known, and I was like, this is the man who's interesting and he has some good thoughts. So, since then, you've become a media and marketing expert as well. So, good for you.
Have I? Well, thank you. I don't really think of myself in that way, but thank you. And we also met recently in Toronto, didn't we?
At the Canadian Aesthetics meeting, and Steve
Yes.
made this very cute little badge. I should have worn it today with a lip instead.
It
It's like no overfilled lips, and it says no
says say
alienation.
no to alienization. Yes.
Yes. So it's funny because everyone came up to me and said, does that say no to lip filler? I was like, no, just alienized lips. So what are alienized lips, and why are we seeing that so much around us?
Gosh, that's a huge topic, but alienized lips are essentially lips which have been distorted, so much so that they don't look right, but also don't function right. And there is an epidemic at the moment of alienized lips, and you just have to look on Instagram or social media to see what's going on, where all lips are reduced to a single lip type, which is that flattened lip with a ledge. And that, of course, also interferes with normal movement because you're busy flattening the lip tubercles, which help with normal movement. And so, why are we seeing so much of that? Well, it's a trend. And trends come and go. And this is the trend at the moment, also known as Russian lip technique. And there are many reasons for that. I think I wrote an article looking at why it is that we alienize our patients in this way. Why is it that patients want to be alienized? And actually, I have a more recent article where we interviewed 35 ladies who had their lips overfilled, and we looked at the motivations for why they were getting their lips overfilled. This was published in Aesthetic Surgery Journal. I teamed up with a group of psychiatrists to look at that, and we found some very interesting results. And actually, social media plays a very big role in this alienization process. I think people want to fit in, they want to be trendy. They see this as a sort of door-opening opportunity for them. They want to live the sort of lifestyle of the influencer. And we hypothesize that they're actually rewarded with likes and followers by following this trend. So Instagram rewards them because this is where they get engagement. And the more engagement, the more money Instagram makes. And so our aesthetic is being propagated or is being driven by social media to a large extent.
That's so true. I mean, I think people are requesting that almost to become a
Yeah.
Bratz, the Bratz dolls. I don't know if you're familiar with Bratz dolls, but
Yes,
that
I am.
Bratz doll look
Yes.
is quite popular, and people do get more social media likes. And it's interesting because lips present differently on video or on photography than they do in person. So someone that looks quite attractive in a picture, when you see them in person, the human brain has that jarring uncanny valley
Yeah,
effect, you know what I mean? Yeah, where they
yes, it
suddenly
doesn't, yeah, it doesn't look quite right, and it makes us feel uncomfortable, doesn't it?
it does, and it just the brain can perceive this extra water pressure and turgor that doesn't belong and doesn't match the hydration level of the rest of the face. And that's why what we're seeing in faces as well, that doughy, bloated, puffy look.
Correct, correct. And as a result of that, with lips, we also have an epidemic of lip filler spread or migration, just as you said at the beginning. So we're seeing a lot of that due to overfilling or just incorrect injection technique, where they're sort of putting a lot of filler in the borders, both the vermilion border and the wet dry border. So we're seeing filler spreading both ways in the white lip, the cutaneous lip, and on the mucosal side as well, and often together. So I spend a lot of time, and today I put up a few stories dissolving this kind of filler spread. It takes up about a quarter of my time. I spend dissolving mainly lips. The other areas, of course, is malar edema. And the other area where I see a lot of spread is actually the nose, the sort of glabella area, the radix of the nose. So these are the common areas for filler spread or migration.
Same. I'm seeing the same thing that you're seeing. I'm also, of course, very concerned about tear trough filler. Like, that is definitely an area of big problems as well. We see in LA the opposite problem also, where we see over dissolving of faces, because there was a trend to say, well, I'm going to erase all my filler and start over. And honestly, seeing those ladies that have had 6 or 8 vials of hyaluronidase applied throughout their face or around their lips or in the lower faces, they deflate so suddenly and so quickly. They get, a lot of fine lines, textural change, and it's virtually impossible to replace hyaluronic in that diffuse manner. The way the hyaluronidase enzyme spreads diffusely, we really can't respread and improve the loss of dermal volume and moisturization that you lose that way. So I don't know if you've seen that yet, but it's notable.
There's a lot of controversy surrounding hyaluronidase itself, which is the sort of the dissolvent, and people talk about it sort of affecting tissues and so forth. But we know that it is an enzyme which is substrate specific to hyaluronic acid, and I think a lot of the sort of effects that we're seeing are actually from the filler itself, from being overfilled, which can have all sorts of effects on the skin, for example, stretching it and so forth. And I think you're right. I think if you're dissolving things too quickly, it can be quite a shock to the system, both physically and psychologically. And I think it's best done slowly and in stages. I think that's my opinion. And of course, preparing the patient what to expect and looking at all other options before actually proceeding with the dissolving itself. In many cases, it's useful to think of other potential options which could help.
What is your technique with the hyaluronidase? Do you add lidocaine? Do you dilute it at all?
Yeah, so we have different brand names. Is Hyalase. We have Hyalase, which is different to Hyalinex. It comes in powdered form, and it's 1,500 units, which we then dissolve in 5 mils or so of bacteriostatic normal saline. And the bacteriostatic bit of normal saline takes the sting out. So that I tend not to use lidocaine or mix it with lidocaine. I find that with bacteriostatic normal saline, it is absolutely fine. And then if I draw 1 mil, that's equivalent to 300 units, which I would typically use to dissolve 1 mil of lip filler.
That's your ratio, about 300 units per 1 mL.
Yes, that's what I find really works very well. What about you?
Well, we do use the human recombinant Hyalinex, which comes in a stingy, more acidic base. So I have been adding lidocaine to that. Initially, I didn't, but then I figured I do believe in hyperdiluting the Hyalinex. So I've been adding sometimes a 1-to-1 ratio of saline with the Hyalinex, sometimes 0.2 or 0.3 of lidocaine, and that itself is a dilution slightly. And so for me, that allows me to cross more territory and have less severe results, more gentle dissolve. And sometimes you don't have to dissolve all the filler, you just have to take it down, 30 or 40%, and it'll sit better. So for me, that's been pretty effective technique. I rarely have to bring people back for 2 or 3 sessions, but mostly that happens with some of the highly cross-linked, higher G prime products. What's your thought on that? Are you having to dissolve
I mean,
sessions?
I think that they're also, I've seen on Instagram they're promoting stiff fillers now in the lips, which I don't think is a great idea for a number of reasons, but also they're also more difficult to dissolve, aren't they? So these high G prime or highly cross-linked fillers, I don't want to mention any names, but Some of the fillers are more difficult to dissolve and can require more than one session. Generally, for the lips, it's fine. I'm able to do it in one session. But it's a matter of watch the space and see what sort of new things are coming around. So that's a bit of a concern with these sort of stiff fillers now going on the lips.
Yeah, definitely. I almost think that the lip envelope can maybe hold a maximum amount of filler before there is just going to be distortion automatically. Like, do you
Yes,
think that
I
there's
agree.
maximum capacity to filling that lip envelope?
Yes, and yes, I do. I use a fairly hydrophilic filler, but using that filler, I find that I can't really put much more than 0.3, 0.4 mil in the superficial dry vermilion, which is the safer area for injection. What we find on ultrasound, and I use a lot of ultrasound, when the patients come in and their lips are overfilled and they've had a mil or so, I can see a lot of it has been put in the muscle. So we do find a lot of filler in the muscle and not where it should be, which is sort of more superficially, because of course in the muscle and behind the muscle you have the arteries, the labial arteries. So you don't really want to go there, and filler also moves in the muscle. So I think if you're careful and injecting superficially around 3 millimeters or so, just below the surface in the dry vermilion area, then I don't think you can put too much filler in there. And the moment you do, it starts spreading outward.
Yeah, true. And I think that the duration of the fillers also is such a factor that, people think they've waited a year, they need to add another syringe. Are you recommending some time delay, or is it just based clinically on being able to palpate fillers still in their lips?
Yeah, that's a great question, because we used to tell patients to come back every few months and then sort of just add, keep adding. But now, of course, as you know, and we know, fillers last a lot longer than what we thought, in some cases, many, many years. And we see the same in the lips. So it's very much a sort of, I think, a clinical decision to be made with the patient. Important to keep those before photos, those initial photos, because patients can have a perception drift. That is, they're with each new treatment, that becomes the sort of their new baseline. And so we have to remind patients of, or keep a record of how they looked initially to compare against. And so I think around 9 to 12 months is a fair time to do a review, but not necessarily treat at that time, but sort of do a consultation and decide together on the best way forward. And sometimes ultrasound can be used as well during that time.
Yeah, that's a great idea to use an ultrasound there. But what are your thoughts on filler degradation science? I don't know if you've done a deep dive, but I'm sure you're very knowledgeable that it was shocking to me to learn that really there have been no studies in the lab or in vivo in animals or humans, either one, that show the duration and longevity of these fillers.
I
Like,
know.
yes, 20 years ago, when the first patents were issued and the first FDA approvals for these products, they were approved as implant products, not pharma products. In pharma, of course, we're going to look at a drug and how it decays and what's its half-life and all of those important measures. But these studies that were initially done for safety, I think were just done in, animals that had lifespan of less than 6 months, animal like rats and mice. And so a bolus of filler was placed on their back, under their skin, and measured and quantified. And then the animal died before, like, how do we know how long the duration of the filler and the product? So they have mathematical formulas that they mapped, created a formula estimating the time frame of for degradation, and then, extrapolated that into the package insert, which is, to me, is freaking shocking. I can't believe
It
that.
is, and they obviously got it very wrong, didn't they?
Exactly. It is very wrong. And I think industry is due to revise and relook at that, because now we have other tools. At least we have ultrasound where you can visualize. Now we have humans that have had filler for the last 10 years. We have, there's kind of a necessity, I would say, to start looking
I
better.
agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I agree. It needs a bit of an overhaul. The industry needs some shaking up.
Yes, you have one slide that I often use in some of my lectures where you talk about a teaspoon of filler is not too much, and the
Oh.
lady's face is blown up so full. And you say that 1 cc of filler can absorb something like several liters of water. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it certainly can absorb a lot of water. So we don't take that into account. So that it occupies more space, it swells. There is that swell factor. And the other thing, which is just as you've said now, and we've been talking about, is the cumulative effect. So, it's not just 1 mil, it's 1 mil plus 1 mil plus 1 mil, because the fillers are lasting a lot more than we thought they were. So there are all these factors to take into account. It's not a matter of saying, well, it's just 1 mil. I don't think that is an appropriate thing to say anymore because it is very misleading, or this fifth of a teaspoon is the one they use, and they always show diagrams showing how little it is, and therefore we should use more. But I think the trend now, I think people are sort of waking up to this realization of the long-term effects of fillers, the negative side of things, the sort of cumulative effect of fillers, and the sort of, as you said, this boggy kind of appearance where you end up fluid-filled. And I think people are realizing that actually less is more, and we really should be using a lot less than what the manufacturers have been encouraging us to use through all sorts of formulas and codes and things like that, which is just a push to use more and more fillers. So we're waking up to that. And I think fillers are actually wonderful and can do some wonderful things, but we need to use them sensibly, like everything else.
It's challenging because patients want instant gratification. So the idea of doing small micro droplet treatments, very, gradual improvements and waiting for the swell factor to kick in to see where you really are with someone's volume is challenging. And also like not that practical for people to come to multiple sessions to treat one area, but that's truly what we should be doing, I think. And in my office, I used to never, sell a half a syringe of filler, but these days I do because I really
Great.
want to tie my hand a little or be able to,
Yeah.
offer this half syringe. And in the past, it would feel wrong to throw away half a syringe and have poor patients pay for that. So we split that. So sometimes we'll do a half syringe, which has been interesting to think
Yeah,
about.
that's great. I think I do the same. I use half syringes for the lips. And you're right, it is a challenge, but I think, the old way of doing things hasn't worked out very well. And so I think we really need to now change our approach and start educating ourselves and our patients as well. And I think these KOLs, these key opinion leaders, also have a responsibility to feedback to the manufacturers and start getting them to really look out more for the interests of the patients than their sales, which is a big problem as well, I think.
Definitely. What do you think about the filler fear that sort of has been a prevalent in the last few months? I think there was like a wave of filler fear, just an overfilled look or people wanting to dissolve, people feeling that there was, too much filler face. It was kind of like after
Well,
Madonna
there's the
went TV award show. And then I remember like the Alice Hart, from the UK
Yes,
was.
Alice Hart Davis, yes.
She had a picture of her face MRI with 20
Yes.
of filler in it. So it
Yes.
was Madonna, then Alice, and then I felt this wave of filler fear coming through like Instagram and patients, and that was the conversation for a while.
Yeah, there was also a lot of unfounded sort of things like this. They came up with, that filler somehow causes cancer because it interferes with the lymphatic system, which of course is nonsense. The evidence for it is just pretty non-existent. And also a lot of surgeons, unfortunately, coming out and sort of speaking out against fillers, knocking them, saying how it affects surgery, which I believe it can, but certainly more studies are needed. So there was this kind of war rivalry developing as well on social media between surgeons and non-surgeons. I know you're a surgeon as well, but some surgeons, not all surgeons, are knocking fillers. And I think there's a middle path, to all this, which we need to start treading, looking at, and following rather than the extremes. So not too much. Obviously, patients want to see a result, so they'll want something, of course, but there is a middle path, I believe, where everyone can be happy, really.
I hope so. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of talk
Yeah.
about biostimulators causing so much fibrosis that you can never do a facelift, and then
Yes, exactly.
people will come in the office and be like, "No, I don't want that. I want to have a facelift in the future." Like the misled,
Yes.
all of this based on like anecdotal evidence. I just
Yes.
want to say like, "Hello, biostimulators have been around for 25 years,
Right.
and deep plane facelifts for 50 years, and this is the first
Yes.
we've heard of it." So like, really. Okay, this definitely gets a lot of attention, and it does bring up a question or an issue, like is the collagen stimulation of those products the same as normal collagen, or is it fibrotic scar, and is there a difference in how it's created? Yeah, I don't know. Do you use biostimulators in your practice?
No, I don't. I'm not crazy about biostimulators personally, simply because I do deal with a lot of complications from them. So maybe I'm just slightly, maybe that's how my ideas have been formed. But for example, let's say nodules forming and sort of granulomas or even overfilling with products like Radiesse can become a nightmare to treat or to try and normalize. So I see a lot of overfilled faces from these because, you know, they're biostimulatory, but they also have a filling effect, of course. I'm kind of really trying to get my head around why one would use something which is not reversible. The effects I see on skin, I mean, people talk about improvement in skin texture. You can also do that with microneedling. So I'm very cautious, or I'm very more than cautious. I probably wouldn't go down that road of using biostimulants simply because they're not reversible and I don't see a massive added benefit to them. But I do see a negative side to them, which worries me, which I see in my or at my normalization clinic. Although I know a lot of colleagues, people use them and swear by them and think that they're wonderful. So there is that side of things as well.
They're amazing. You're going to have to come to
There we
my
go.
lecture. They are amazing. And the idea that they can produce volume is very true, but you really have to be an artist when you analyze the face, and we're going to use that power to our advantage in the temple area and the
Right.
preauricular and the pregeal sulcus, the areas that need volumization. And a little more dermal thickness. The dermal thickening is incredible, and that's very nice. But I would agree. I mean, maybe it's because in the UK, there's not a lot of licensing and regulatory, and anybody can do fillers and they don't have to be super
Yeah,
experienced.
it's
So you're
true.
getting, yes, if you shoot up a face with Sculptra or you shoot it up with Radiesse, yes, you will get a big fat face. But you have to place these very strategically and artistically. And I'm getting amazing results with that. I would say my patients who've been on biostimulators, they love them so much. They are on them for 5, 10 years and beyond. I do my own mom's face, and she's beautiful and fabulous. And like, I think these patients may never need a facelift until they get like extreme laxity. They're just maintained and they look refreshed. And I'm such a super fan. But honestly, like with a busy, high volume use of the products and correct use, like I never get a nodule, knock on wood. But it's extremely rare. And I would say when and if they do come, it's related to like, too much injection in one location or unsterile situation on the skin.
Right.
And I've only ever seen one patient who had like an extreme reaction and lots of volume in her face. And that's super, super rare. I think that every patient has had really lovely results with both the Sculptra and the Radiesse. So.
Well, there you go. So, you know, so you've obviously seen a very positive side to it and obviously use it a lot. I probably just
Yes.
because I deal with a lot of the complications from it that I
And that must be like very hard to deal with too, because they're difficult.
Yeah, they're difficult to deal with because they're not easily reversed or they're non-reversible,
And
or
I
trying to
think,
reverse them creates its own problems.
yeah, that's very true. I think being a surgeon, I'm used to doing things that are not reversible, like a facelift or rhinoplasty, eyelid surgery. None of
Yeah.
them are reversible. You're permanently cutting out skin and tightening it.
Yes.
So it's like it's maybe the nature of things. For me, it's very kind of a normal idea that everything changes. But this, I think that neocollagenesis is kind of amazing. The other
Yeah.
really super amazing thing about biostimulators is they bring in so many macrophages to the treatment site that I'm having good results with. I think they're remodeling old filler breakdown products, the hyaluronic acid gel. That breaks down from long chains to shorter chains to small fragments. It just sits there in the face. It just sits there. It doesn't go anywhere. And to metabolize, it takes forever. But I think the macrophages that come in when I use biostimulator help to gobble up those filler fragments.
Yes,
A macrophage
I was
scavenging
sitting right
theory.
next to you when you spoke about that at the
Yes.
conference. That's your theory on what happens.
Yes, and how it can
Yes.
transform that kind of boggy, water pressurized face into backwards into like a much more natural and refreshed look. So
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting hypothesis. I think with respect to fillers, and I think this applies to biostimulators as well, I say, you know, use whatever works for you and your patients. And as long as you're executing it safely, performing the procedure safely, which obviously you are, and not going overboard, then I think then that's fine. Then
Yeah, more power to
Carry
you.
on.
Yes. Tell me a little bit about your non-surgical lip tubercle technique and how you developed it and how you think it's very different from
Yeah.
other methods that are out there.
Well, I developed it many, many years ago. I mean, talk about 6, 7 years ago. We've since published my lip classification of tubercles, which is a way of distinguishing different lip types or classifying different lip types based on the appearance of their tubercles.
For the general audience that's listening, could you
Yes.
explain what is a tubercle and why is that relevant?
These are embryological remnants of developments. Of development. So they're just these little pillows of the lips. They're like little projections or dermal projections of the lips. And we typically have three tubercles on the top lip and two on the bottom. And as we're developing in the uterus, parts of our faces go through a process of extension and fusion. And this happens in the mouth area as well. And the remnants of that are these little projections. And you can see, I mean, if you go to my profile on Instagram, I talk a lot about it, and there is an article on it in Aesthetic Surgery Journal looking at our classification of tubercles, and we found 16 different combinations or types of lip. And the significance of that is that we can treat individual lips individually. So we can keep individual lip shapes rather than trying to sort of make them all look the same. And the significance of these little projections, tubercles, is not only in forming unique shapes, giving individual shapes, but plays a role, we believe, in movement. It gathers extra surface area in much the same way that the filtral columns do and allow for normal lip or mouth movement. And so that is another important thing to consider. And so my technique, the non-surgical lip tubercle technique, really focuses, identifies the lip type, and then enhances it based on the appearance of the patient's or the person's tubercles rather than trying to recreate anything else. And what it does is it softens the transitions between the tubercles, typically in the upper lip. And in the lower lip, for example, it might enhance the tubercles depending on the lip type. So the secret really is keeping the individual lip type to maintain individuality as well as normal function. And that really, in essence, is what it's all about.
Well, it's a beautiful technique, and I love the embryologic origin and emphasizing actually where the highlight points and the human eye sees best. So I think it's very artistic and lovely.
Thank you. And
Yeah,
yeah.
I
And the
definitely.
lips have, if you look at it, it creates a kind of hills and valleys in the lip, which we have on the face as well. And I think when we're doing facial aesthetics, we want to soften the transition between sort of light and shade areas. We want something which flows a little bit more. And so it's no different in the lips. So we're kind of smoothing out the transitions and we're highlighting light reflexes, particularly on the lower lip tubercles, and it looks just beautiful.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. The hills and valleys make the beauty versus like a lip that's very stiff and overfilled and has no, it's all just one sausage versus like having those variations. But there are definitely girls in LA that would be disappointed with that subtlety. And all over the world. And this is the problem we face as injectors. Like you can be very educated and intellectual about it, and yet girls kind of want to look like they had a little bit of lip filler because it's a little sexy. How do you judge? How do you bridge that?
Well, first of all, normal, I think, can be sexy. So that's number one. Number two is, I think,
That
yes, I
needs to
mean,
be a
there are
button.
trends. What?
You need to make that into a button. Normal
Normal
can't
is sexy.
be
And yes, people want to be trendy, not only with lips, I mean, with everything, fashion and so forth. But and so one needs to take that into account. But we also need to then consider, well, what are the risks involved in distorting lips? We have to remember our duty of care, of course, which is to do no harm. And so that, I think, that has to be at the forefront of what we do. So I think as long as you are performing a procedure where you are not subjecting the patient to increased risk or not causing a sort of a distortion or affecting function in any way, then that's fine. I think you can do some of these vertical type injections, and you can perform them in a way which is safe. But I think the way they're being done now, in a very exaggerated sense, creates a very odd flat looking lip, which is the same for everyone. And that can't be right, because there are risks involved in doing this procedure. And so I think we need to take all that into account. And you can make a lip much larger if you want, but in a way which doesn't completely distort the lip and create a sort of new alien lip type, I believe, and can look very, very sexy. But of course, there will be people who want a flat lip with a ledge, and you know, and
The
the way
Russian,
I
yeah.
the Russian lips, I mean, there are many, many people want it. It is extremely popular on social media, and people do request it. But when they come to me, they don't request it.
You've self-selected a particular group of very poised and elegant ladies, I'm sure. But yesterday I saw a patient who opened her phone and showed me a Russian lip, and I enlarged it for her and I said, "You see that they've put some highlighter, like a brown pencil, over shadowing the top of the lip, and there is makeup all around, and the lips don't actually come up off the page like a Bratz doll like that. That's not real." And she didn't want to believe me. She was like,
This is true. So that's a very good point you raise. There's a lot of deception, which I really, it sort of makes my blood boil, on social media, and that is this applying makeup immediately after the procedure and hiding that ledge with foundation and sort of showing the patient sort of upside down or whatever, and never ever showing long-term results or the patient moving or smiling. And I think that's deceptive. So that is a
yeah,
big problem, I think.
that's true. That's so true. If instead of a after picture, they need to show the patient talking like 3 months later and how
Yes,
her lips
show, or at
felt.
least just show the patient smiling, and then just do one picture where you actually, where we can see the patient a few months down the line. Because when they come to my clinic, and a lot of them have had Russian lips because it causes a lot of problems, they come in and it's not a flat lip anymore, I can tell you, because we know from ultrasound the filler does not stand up vertically and hold the lip up. It doesn't. It moves along a direction of least resistance. And in the lips, it's more horizontal because the lips are wider than they are taller. And that is the way it organizes itself, more horizontally. And so even though you get an immediate effect, which they show immediately on Instagram, you don't see that long term.
It's very true. In terms of reversing overfilled bases themselves, what are you doing for that? And how can practitioners start to address these problems with their patients? It's a touchy conversation to have because people come in wanting more lip filler and more, more definition. They want that initial feeling of joy and like that endorphin release that comes when you see your fresh filler. But I don't want to steal from them that, but I do want to steer them in a whole nother direction. So do you have any tips for that conversation?
I think it's about being open, and discussing the risks involved, and as you say, the sort of the long-term effects of everything that we're doing, you know. And it might even help to show some pictures. I mean, there's no shortage of overfilled or complications from these things, even on social media. You can see what it does on the long run. And I don't think they would be interested in having these type of long-term effects or complications. So there is that. And I think also, if you start putting up normal results on your Instagram profile, in other words, show how you normalize results and how you care about it, then you draw that kind of patient towards you. You know, when patients are looking for a practitioner, they go to Instagram, they go to social media these days to look for one, and you can actually help in the selection process that way. So put up what you believe or what you feel passionately about and what you feel is right, and you will attract that kind of patient as well. Now, in my normalization clinic, I do a lot of corrective work, so I see a lot of the overfilled patients, the lot of distortions. And one needs to also then consider the psychological side of things. Why did they get distorted, or why did they get so overfilled in the first place? Because if you then dissolve everything for these patients, you could run into problems in terms of their mental state, their psychological health. So you always have to consider patient psychology when considering the process of dissolving. It needs to be part of the process. Really, really important. And then, as we said at the beginning, I think it's a good idea to do things in stages rather than dissolve everything at once, which can be quite a shock to the system and can be a shock psychologically as well.
Are you using ultrasound in your dissolving process these days?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Even today, if you go to my stories, you can see ultrasound guided dissolving. All my procedures these days involve ultrasound, and that's when I place filler as well, except for the lips. That's the one place where I don't use ultrasound guided injections for placement of filler. But when it comes to dissolving, it's all ultrasound guided, or at least just a quick look with ultrasound just to see where the filler is, and then using a needle to inject in that place. So ultrasound is great because it really is, it acts as our eyes on the inside. It allows us to see exactly where the filler is, how much of it there is, and then we can also more precisely dissolve it using less hyaluronidase with better outcomes as well. So ultrasound really is, I think, an invaluable tool. I think that it's fast becoming, in my opinion, an essential part of practice. I think it will be one day. I think maybe still a few years to go, but certainly in my practice, it has become an integral part of everything I do. So I highly, highly recommend it.
Yeah, I think if you do buy an ultrasound, you do have to use it on every patient, because I see people buying
Yes.
it, setting it aside and waiting for an occlusion, or, you know, like, you really need to
start
Yes. using it on every single patient. I personally don't use ultrasound. I don't think I never will. Because I just really work a lot with digital palpation and touching landmarks and foramina. And, you know, I'm sure that it's more accurate, perhaps, read ultrasound, but I'm not an ultrasonographer. So I think the process
Sure.
of learning all those sound waves on the staticky screen is going to be challenging for the average person.
No, it is challenging. And I don't think you need to be an ultrasonographer. I think actually most of us aren't and are using ultrasound, but I agree that it's not an easy thing to learn. It does take a bit of time and a bit of commitment, but still, I think it's an invaluable tool. And boy, oh boy, does it force you to know your anatomy, because you really need to know what you're looking at and looking for. And I think so, you know, besides everything we've said, I think it's a great way to actually learn or teach anatomy. It is really amazing.
It's a great learning and mapping tool. Have you seen that Artery 3D, the AI that they've used now to scan facial arteries? It's an MRI. You first go get a facial MRI, and then they upload the MRI database into an app, and then you can literally overlay it on the patient's face. And
yes.
Like,
yes.
Long
the
haul
only thing
for
I don't
stretch.
Like about that is the only thing I know the developer of that software. The only thing I don't like about that is it doesn't give you real-time anatomy. So
yeah.
I don't think it's a substitute for ultrasound. Ultrasound is real-time. It's actually there in front of you.
Right.
So
the
problem with that MRI thing is that things change, and I don't think it can sort of account for those kind of changes. So I still think ultrasound is the way forward. But
yeah,
it's an interesting concept. I mean, it's
it
an
is,
interesting idea.
Not to mention like a $2,000 MRI of your face to go
Well,
do appointment in order to get lip filler. Nobody's going to do that. But I think one day maybe that'll be the standard, that we get our whole body scanned and mapped, and then that data gets, you know, transformed into a Star Trek body scanning device. That would
maybe.
be wonderful. What else do you see as emerging trends in aesthetics coming up in the future?
Gosh, well, there's all these things on sort of polynucleotides and exosomes and all these sort of latest treatments to come about. I think that they hold a lot of promise. I think that is one avenue that I think will be going down. I don't think the technology is quite there yet, but I like the idea of that. So I think there is going to be a lot more going on in that sense. I think, you know, Botox and fillers will always be around, or at least in the foreseeable future, but I think people will start taking a little bit of a step back from that and not doing as much. I think there is a trend to do less and less of that. I don't think it will disappear. I think it's here to stay, but just done in a more measured way. And I think skincare is a really big thing. So I think watch that space for new developments. And I don't know, but AI is going to play some sort of role in all this. I'm not quite sure what, but I do see a lot of potential for where it can possibly help. What do you think?
Very similar. I think I'm very super skeptical about all the new companies popping up with polynucleotides exosomes, and
Yes.
I don't know. I just wonder, like, am I going to use salmon sperm? Am I a salmon? I'm not sure that I need plant stem cells because I'm not a plant.
Yeah.
I just want people to read the science and respect the science and like go do a
Yes.
deep dive before you buy something on an exhibit hall floor. So there are
Exactly, exactly.
so many brands of exosomes popping up. They need to understand the source, the purity, like the implications of introducing foreign DNA fragments into another person from another person.
Yes.
Like it's an immune sensitivity issue. So I want to learn it before I teach it. So I'm holding back, but I have my skepticism.
No, I do too, and I think it's an interesting technology, and may present sort of a kind of pathway to the future. But I don't think we're there yet. I think we're a bit ahead of ourselves at the moment with that.
Yeah, I think that there's super extreme potential, but I also fear a little bit for like the immune sensitivities that can be created from taking someone else's
Yes.
DNA and RNA fragments, cross species, et cetera, or donors that you don't know. Like, I mean, where do you get platelet donor products from like drug addicts that donate their blood and from blood banks
Right.
supplies that are
Yeah.
expiring? And like, do I really want fragments of that in my system? I don't know. Not sure yet. Not sure. I have to think,
Right.
really figure out which companies are sourcing the most ideal source. And then I think the human recombinant DNA technology is probably the best. Like platelet drive growth factor is very, very potent, and their recombinant technology, like that is ideal because that is manufactured and does not have those immune issues, hopefully. But that's a whole nother podcast. But but you're right. I think for me, the biostimulators, the things that turn on anti-aging from the cellular clock level, are going to be so amazing in this next
Yes.
decade. Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
And you're gonna, Stephen is gonna continue to innovate artistic and beautiful techniques and keep bringing us back
Hope so.
to normal is sexy is gonna be
Normal is sexy.
the
Yes, that's the next badge. I
new
think that's a brilliant idea.
It is a brilliant idea. Well, I can't wait to see you again at the next meeting. I know you're lecturing in October at the CMAC meeting as complications, medical aesthetics management type of stuff, right?
That's correct, and that'll be in London. I think it's October 4th, and it's a fabulous conference where the speakers are non-sponsored, so it's a breath of fresh air.
I love that idea. I think I should come October. I'm going to check
You
it out.
should.
I should. Well, it's been a lovely podcast and so wonderful to catch
It
up
has.
with you. Yeah, I have so much respect for your work and you're very intellectual, and I love your artistic hand too. So, where
Thank
can
you.
people find you if they want to connect and learn more? And I saw you teaching your non-surgical lip tubercle technique. I definitely
Yes.
recommend you guys should try that if you're an injector.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I make announcements for that on Instagram, and I also teach ultrasound. But if they follow me at Dr. Harris Clinic and have a look at stories, I put stuff up there almost every day from my normalization clinic. So a lot of interesting stuff.
Amazing. So check out Dr. Harris. And that's it for now, guys. You can find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, DrKay. And our website is the same, beautybydrk.com. That's where you can find our amazing skincare. And I definitely am a super fan. Check out Stephen's page as well. And I hope to see you guys with normal, non-alienized faces, great injectors working on you. That's it for now, guys. Stay beautiful.